Welcome, everybody, to the Orca Month Book Club, co-hosted by Colleen Weiler, Jessica Rico's fellow with Whale and Dolphin Conservation, and myself, Whitney Negebauer from Whale Scout. Today, we are talking with Alexandra Morton. She is the author of Listening to Whales, What the Orcas Can Teach Us. So, Colleen, welcome again. It's good to hear from you.
Hi, Whitney. Thanks for having me on this month. It's been really fun and enjoying reading all these great books for Orca Month Book Club.
And welcome, Alexandra Morton. How are you today?
I'm really good. Thank you also for having me on this show. It's great to talk to all of you whale people.
Well, we're so happy to be talking with you. Let's just jump right into it. This book is about whales, but it's also so much about your life and your personal journey. How did you decide to write this book?
Well, people are naturally interested in whales, and when you're a scientist, there's a lot of information that you can get across in the form of scientific papers, but I think the way people really learn is through stories, particularly if they can follow one person's life. And I know Dr. Jane Goodall had such a huge impact on me and continues to have a huge impact on me because she was willing to share her story, her life. And so I have become so dedicated to protecting the whales, protecting their habitat, that the more people know and love the whales, the safer they are. So that's why I wrote the book.
Speaking of Jane Goodall, you know, you mentioned in the book that there was really a lack of female scientist role models when you were younger until you saw her on the cover of National Geographic. And that was just a big inspiration and kind of, you know, if she can do it, I can too. And starting with your story, you are one of the few women in the field of marine mammal science, which was really, really male-dominated at the very beginning. So what was it like to be one of the first women working in that field?
You know, I know it's a struggle for women that are working in large institutions and maybe even societies, but I was always such a loner, just went out, found a place, began the study, that I really wasn't influenced by any kind of male domination. And I noticed that the guys were doing the real exploratory work, like going to the Arctic, the Antarctic. They really were pushing the boundaries of our understanding. But what seems almost uniquely female is the ability to stay in one place and watch something for a really long time. And, you know, Dr. Goodall pioneered that, but there's been a lot of us since then. And so I do see a divide in the work. And maybe it's because I was raising children in the area. Maybe not. I think I just was able to get down to the pace of the place and really watch it. And that's when you start to understand how everything's related, what's normal, what's unusual, and what are the whales doing, which is always so complicated and interesting.
In the book, you mention you initially got started working with cetaceans with John Lilly, who is, you know, sort of a controversial figure in marine mammal science. You know, what was that like shaping your career?
Well, it put me outside the establishment right away. He faced a lot of opposition because his work, first as a neuroscientist and then with the experiments he was doing, led him to believe that the dolphins were intelligent on a par with us, or perhaps in some ways more intelligent, whatever that exactly means. And so as soon as I wanted to move to live animals and wanted to observe animals in an oceanarium, there was a little bit of, ooh, you work for John Lilly. Well, that was something to overcome. But what it did was really expanded my boundaries. Matter of fact, just dissolved the boundaries. And so I was open to really assessing these creatures myself without any kind of, uh-oh, I better not, you know, go too far here. I better not attribute too much intelligence to them. And I certainly encountered that later, because if you did, then you were just not really a scientist. If you wanted to think that the dolphins were more intelligent than, say, pigs, you ran into being discredited.
It seems like, you know, speaking of that kind of difficulty in trying not to assign specific characteristics to whales and dolphins, and trying to anthropomorphize them, but then when you get to know them as individuals and with your work in the wild, sometimes it seems like scientists can't really help themselves when it comes to whales and dolphins, because you get to know them so well and see these amazing occurrences that kind of changes your mind a little.
Yes. Well, first of all, we're looking at everything through human eyes. So you're always anthropomorphizing to some degree, because we're looking at everything with our experience through that lens. But they're mammals with long-term relationships, incredibly dedicated to their young. They sense fear, separation. And so to simply discount that they could have any of these feelings is really going to set your work back. But what you have to do all the time is try to like look at it from all different angles. Look at it again and again and again in different situations. And keep a really open mind. Like, don't get locked into thinking, oh, this is my theory and, you know, I'm going to defend this ground really no matter what. You have to be always willing to be wrong. And I think if you can persist with that, in my view, you get a fair analysis of what is going on. I mean, I saw Corky lose her babies, have them taken away, and to not attribute grief to the display that went on for days after that occurred would have been dishonest to the science itself. And so, you really just have to be fearless. And here Jane Goodall was a real example. She ran into opposition because instead of numbering the chimpanzees she was working with, she named them. And just that set off the scientific community, which I also understand, because as scientists, you have to try to make sure that your observations are valid and that your hypotheses are supported by your data. But at the same time, you cannot take the, I don't want to call it humanity, but emotion. Because we all of us have dogs. No, they have emotions. And so it's a balance, but you really have to do it. Otherwise, you are then biased in another direction that I think invalidates your work.
In all of your time working with both captive and wild whales, what has been some of the biggest surprises that you have experienced?
I don't know if I could really talk to surprises, because I went into it without very many preconceptions, but there's nothing random about orcas and the things they do. And it's only long-term experience that allows you to see that. But they are very sensitive to their habitat and what is going on, and they know exactly what is going on. And they want to, you know, enter the archipelago that I was working in at the beginning of a ebb tide, and they knew all of the fish populations and were there to greet them and meet them. The complexity of their society, where we saw one family of resident orca, the A1s, they basically owned Johnson Straits. That's the wrong word, but they were the ones who came first, and then they would go out to the west and they'd pick up other members and then they'd bring them in. And I'm always thinking, well, how did they know that that group was coming in? Because they would go out and come back quite quickly. Was that group out there waiting, or did they have long distance communication, or was there just a preset date? So yeah, one of the most surprising things was the level of culture and organization. And I think the other thing was, you know, during my early years of whale research, I was having children. And so I was experiencing the very, very strong bond with my babies. But honestly, the whales were at another level. They were breathing together. Their babies and them were opening their blowholes the exact same second. And I observed in the wild where mother whales looked like they were off doing their thing and their kids were off doing another thing. But if the mothers went around a point and could no longer hear their children, they would come racing back calling, and the baby would come calling and splashing up to them, and they'd reunite and then off they go. And I realized that maybe because they were living in a dark world and they couldn't really see each other, that the level of connection between the mothers and the offsprings is not only tighter than us, but longer in duration, because after their mothers died. There's no reason for them to have died. They're still able to hunt. But like A5, when he lost his mother, A9, and his brother, both of them died very shortly thereafter. And this has been seen a number of times. So their bonds are tighter than ours.
You talked about doing research with Corky at the very beginning, and just those absolutely heartbreaking stories about watching her go through these pregnancies and lose her calves. And you were having, you know, your children at kind of the same time. So did having that observation of her and connection to her, and then seeing Corky's family in the wilds, change your perspective on captivity?
Oh, yes. So when I started, first of all, I thought the orcas were extremely boring, and I wasn't interested in studying them. I'd go straight to the bottlenose dolphin tanks. But when Corky gave birth, so the first little orca conceived and born in captivity, convinced me to put my hydrophones in her tank. And the minute I did that, or not the minute, but after several days of actually not sleeping and just watching them around the clock because it was so interesting, I realized this was the animal that I could probably was best suited for me. I was just locked in. Their calls were so beautiful. Their behaviors were slow. I could keep up with them. But, you know, they're smiling. And so it was easy at first to think, well, yeah, they're in captivity, and I know that's abnormal, but, you know, they look pretty happy. They were doing stuff, and they had a very tight relationship, and they were all about those trainers and, you know, pushing the boundaries with them all the time. They're very interactive. But then when I saw the babies dying repeatedly and Corky's grief, I mean, she would literally go to the bottom. Well, first of all, she was all about them, and after they were born, she was right on them, but the tank was circular. So she had to constantly get out in front of that baby because it kept ramming into the concrete wall, which would shatter its lower jaw. So she was unable to nurse them because of this circular situation. And then the babies began crying because they were starving. And eventually the people were really trying. I don't want to that they weren't. They were really trying. But eventually they would take the babies out, and their intentions were always to put the babies, they got it feeding on some kind of tube feeding or a bottle. And so there was that moment when the baby would be lifted out of the water in the sling, and suddenly that had acoustic contact Corky, and she would never hear those babies again. And she just would slam the platform where the trainers operated. That was the part of the tank that she put all of her grief and angst into. She never hurt the people.
flap up, and she'd just go on the bottom of the tank and lie there for 3 days. And she'd come up and get air, and she'd lie there on the bottom, and she just did this one call over and over and over again. And I had to accept that was grief. And then I was able to track down her family in British Columbia. And I'll tell you, I went up there and I, you know, pumped up my boat and had all the equipment in. I had no experience with the water or boats or anything. And I was a bit scared, to be honest. And I'm kind of tied to the dock and it's getting sunset starting. And suddenly there's a pod of whales. And I let go and I went out to them, puttered out. I stopped. I put the hydrophones down. And the moment I heard their sounds in the wild, sounds that they were now echoing 4 or 5 times. And I watched these babies, you know, climbing over their moms and ripping around. And I was just like, oh, my God, Corky should be here, not me. And just felt, you know, deep stabbing guilt. And, you know, I went back and worked with her for a couple more years. But I always felt she knew. And, you know, I still very, very uncomfortable with it. And I didn't do enough to bring her back to her family. It's a terrible piece of my life that I've never been able to reconcile. So yeah, definitely changed me.
And when you began working with wild whales, some of the people that sort of guided you were Michael Bigg and Paul Spong. What was it like working with them?
Well, Paul was building his little research station, and they were looking for researchers to come and use it. And so he basically, I wouldn't have gotten to British Columbia without him. So he's like, here's a place. So I went there, and then he didn't exert too much influence. He was always there for questions. He definitely had his viewpoints, but he let you discover on your own, which was wonderful. And then Mike, you know, my experience as an American scientist was that the older scientists just didn't really want to talk to us youngsters. And so when I wrote to Mike Bigg and I asked him, do you know what family, what pod Corky came from? And he answered me with a stack of copied pictures of her family and said, go to Alert Bay in August. I was stunned at the openness and the, I'd like to say it was respect, but I'm not even sure he thought that far. He was just like, here's a scientist, here's somebody who's asking me about these whales, and I'm going to provide information. And so Mike was just a wealth of information. You know, I'm so sorry that he passed away, because he was a very thoughtful person. And, you know, he's the one that discovered that these whales could be identified by the saddle marks and the dorsal fin shape, and began to put together their families. And so he changed things for the whales, because once every whale was named, nobody could go in and capture them. Because then the debate was, oh, do you take the only daughter, or do you take the mom, or do you take the son? You suddenly knew these things as families, these whales as families, and it became impossible to take them. It was. I don't think he set out to do this, but he protected them by giving them all, identifying all of them.
Working with Michael Bigg, you know, you mentioned he sent you that information about Corky's family, and that kind of inspired you to go up to British Columbia and start studying them in the wilds. Initially, did researchers working in captivity collaborate with researchers working on wild orcas, or did it take some time to kind of build a connection and make that bridge between the two?
I don't really know that there is a bridge.
I guess.
So
you were a bridge.
Yes, but you know, I guess I burned the bridge. But really, what research is being done in captivity? What are we? We're learning that this is wrong.
Right.
I sat up in a booth where the children visiting the park couldn't see me. And so it was as much as observing the whales, I was observing the children observing the whales. And they were trying to throw popcorn down their blowholes. And they were arguing whether these were real or was this like the dinosaurs at Disneyland. They were learning disrespect. They were learning interspecies racism. I wanted to take those children and put them on a small rock as a pod of whales went by and to see the awe and fear and respect that that would bring. The line was always, oh, we learn so much from whales in captivity. No, we don't. We don't learn anything except that they are inherently gentle. And even though the first one was harpooned and dragged into Vancouver, that whale was gentle. But once we learn that, once we learn this is wrong, well, then you really have to adapt to that knowledge. And of course, they're a huge money draw. And so organizations like SeaWorld worked very, very hard not to call them babies. They were calves. And oh, they were grown up by the time they were five. And, you know, there was all these things that people in the wild were seeing were just not true. So I don't really know what we have learned from whales in captivity, except that they really do not belong there. And to put them there is a disservice to the children who are watching them.
When you were doing research in the wild, you kind of talk about the husband and wife team that you created with Robin, and that he was the eyes and you were the ears, and that your work was really focused on and listening and seeing. You know, what initially and throughout your work were you hoping to learn?
Well, so as a child, I wanted to start studying communication in a non-human. I just felt this real unease with the human language and felt like there was so much room for misunderstanding. And that, and so I wanted to study communication in a large brain. And that was basically, there were three choices, primates, elephants, and cetaceans. And I picked cetaceans for a number of reasons. And so that was my plumb line. That's why I went to work with Lily. That's why I went to the Oceanarium. That's why I went to the North. And when I realized you could not study a language in a tank, like I was so excited when those babies were born because I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to study a baby whale learning its language. And that is going to be a, you know, huge opportunity to see how this thing works. But when I realized I was studying animals that were being driven insane by their situation, and I had to go to the wild. And so I put myself, I found the place where the whales come to, and I put myself there. And I was really hoping to kind of crack the door on the isolation of our species. What are they thinking? Why do they have this large brain? Brains take a lot of oxygen. And so it's a difficult organ. It's an expensive organ for a whale to run. They've got to keep oxygenating it while they're holding their breath and trying to, you know, get oxygen to all of their muscles. So if they didn't need it, they wouldn't have it. And I dreamed in whale calls and thought about them all the time. I divided them. I could see that there was a main call and then there were prefixes and suffixes. I had a voice notes, and so I recorded them, the whales with one track with an underwater mic, and then a voice note about what they were doing. And then I graphed them. I assigned each call a color, so I make these long charts so I could look at it, because I'm a visual species and they're an acoustic species. And you know, you could see that the calls were associated with different things. There is one call that is very interesting because it seems to be correlated with the act of synchrony, whatever that synchrony is. And whales are all about synchrony. They want to breathe together, which is always so interesting. I wanted to know what they were thinking. I realize now, our connection between our brain and our ear is like a little dirt path. But the whale has, a six-lane highway. There's so much more data
transmitted between their ears and their brains, that they may be creating holistic images as they call back and forth across the channel. When they hear the calls from their pod mates, they could, you know, potentially see what has been dropped out of that call by what the sound hit. And so they might be able to see like whole schools of fish or other whales or who knows what, temperature differences. So it's unlikely that we really be able to bridge that gap and know what they're thinking. But that was what I set out to do.
One of the, I think, most interesting vocalizations that you heard and that you wrote about in the book was whispering, or these kind of like very quiet vocalizations during playtime that you couldn't really hear until you got closer to the whales. Can you tell us more about what that is and how you found that they were making those calls to each other?
That wasn't the most interesting calls, but yeah, they were very cute. So they're just like whistles, and they're sort of very wandery, like little, I don't know, conversations. And you wouldn't notice them until a group of playing whales just like went under the boat. And then they became audible. They were very, because they were high frequency, they didn't travel well. They obviously weren't being produced at a high amplitude. Some people have called them Looney Tunes because you can't catalog them except as a group on their own. Like there's no I couldn't make sense of individual calls. It seemed to modulate all over the place. And so, yeah, it was, I don't know what conversation, what they were talking about that they didn't want the rest of the groups to hear, but, yeah, they definitely individuals had private conversations because other calls were clearly audible for me with my rudimentary equipment, 10 kilometers or sorry, 10 miles apart. So they're very loud when they want to be, but apparently they don't always want to be loud.
Well, then I have to follow up and ask, what were the most interesting calls for you?
So the most interesting call is one that I called F1, and it goes like this. It goes, pow. And when the first time I really ran into it was when Corky was mourning on the bottom of the tank. She was making another call. She was going, like that endlessly. And the male was circling above her. And every once in a while, he just said, pow. And she didn't answer him. And then generally 3 days approximately after the death of the baby or the removal of the baby, always in the middle of the night, she would answer him with the same call. And she'd rise to the surface, and the two of them would then start swimming around together in perfect unison, blowing, you know, exact same second, doing this one call back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then the next morning, invariably, she was kind of back in action. She would eat again. She would look at the trainers. You know, she wasn't fine, but she was behaving normally. And then in the wild, I realized this call was the most common call when the group of whales would get to an intersection and they had to make a choice to go straight or left or right, and they would call back and forth with this call again, and everybody would make the same turn. And then it also spiked in the one birth that we've recorded in northern resident whales in the A clans. And I was like, okay, what do these three situations have in common? You know, this healing of grief and entering, you know, leaving this phase of grief, an intersection, and everybody gathered around watching a whale being born. And I realized it was synchrony between the individuals that were making the call. And it's an interesting call because if the whale's headed away from you, it goes, ear. If the whale's heading towards you, you get the first part. It goes, ear. And some of them put a little tail on it. So it goes, ear. And so, yeah, this was a call that was associated with a concept, not a behavior. And so it was very exciting to me. I don't know if I'm correct that it was associated with synchrony, but certainly, you know, there's evidence that it is.
In the book, you share some stories of some pretty remarkable acts by the whales, either with you personally, where they were guiding you out of fog banks, or from hearing from other people in British Columbia in the area, like two separate dog rescues. What, you know, do you have any idea what the I guess, you know, why the whales would do those things, those really remarkable behaviors?
Yes. Well, of course, I exerted a lot of thought on this. You know, the fog instance was one where I was lost and panicking, and they clustered around my boat, took me to the edge of the fog, and then they themselves went back the direction they were going. And the two dog stories were dogs who are very attached to their human. The human goes out in the boat. The dog's not there when they get back. The human is distressed, really distressed. And then they hear the whales, and here's their dog at night, in very bad condition, but alive. So I began to, and I'm not the only one, began to be very careful about my thoughts around whales, because at some level, I had to accept the potential that these animals can pick up what you're thinking at specific moments. And don't try a thought experiment on them, because they're not into it. It's not going to work. It may not even be getting through. But if you're really feeling something, they might pick up on it. The other thing that happened was I was at a meeting in Paul Spong's place, and whale captures were being discussed. And one of the researchers just threw out on the floor, you know, maybe we should be capturing entire family units. And then he went on to say, maybe it should be the A4s. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. No, the A4s, those are two sisters. They've lost their mother. They've had a lot of hardship. You know, I was very upset. And Paul's like, Alex, we're just talking theoretically. And so I calmed down. But 2 days later, I'm out with the A4s. And they clustered around my boat and would not let me move. Every time I tried to go forward, they would surface like right at the bow of the boat. This is a little inflatable. And then they took me down what's called Kramer Pass, where I had never seen them go. They turned around the bottom of Kramer Pass and came back. And then they turned around the top of Kramer Pass and went south again. And when I had been asked to give a presentation at Paul's at that same meeting about where I'd seen the whales, I said, I see them everywhere except Kramer Pass. Well, so after this all happened, I was like, okay, you guys heard me. And you're thanking me. I mean, what was I supposed to think? And there's a whole lot of experiences like that, and other people have them as well. It's kind of a well-kept secret among whale researchers, because you don't want to sound like a freak for admitting that these things are happening. But there's only so many coincidences that can stack up before you have to accept there's something else going on there.
Could you describe for us a little bit about how you shifted your research from resident killer whales to transient orcas and then into salmon and salmon farms?
Right. Well, I didn't want to shift my research into studying the transients, because honestly, I found the kill hard to watch. But because I was the first researcher to work in an area over the winter from a boat. You know, Paul was out at his place, but I was following them around. And what I noticed very quickly was that transients basically moved in over the winter, and I was getting lots of sightings, and Mike Bigg was excited about it. And he's like, Alex, you know, be really great if you could do photo IDs. So I was following them around. They're so silent until they make a kill, and then they talk. So they were so silent. So I wasn't out there to study just whales. I was out to study whale communication. So they were a tough whale to work with. I also had some experiences with them where I was just like, okay, I got to really just
you know, be careful with my thoughts. Because I did have them come after me a couple of times, which was really frightening as I had children in the boat. They never touched me, but I did learn to respect them. But then, yeah, Salmon Farms moved in. And this, I was living in a tiny community of about 100 people, off-grid. There's no electricity. There's no ferry. There's no roads. We're really lovely, remote float house community with a one-room school, which is one of the reasons I moved there. And the salmon farming industry moved in. And at first I thought, wow, great idea. There's going to be more jobs, more kids. Raising salmon in a pen sounds like a great idea. Let the wild ones, you know, feed the whales. But very rapidly, it became clear that salmon farms are feedlots, and feedlots amplify viruses, parasites, and bacteria. And because they began raising Atlantic salmon, novel viruses appeared, sea lice populations exploded, started eating the wild salmon to death, and we began to get algae blooms because of the tons of nitrogen and phosphorus coming out of these farms. They took their families out and went to crew. They did not want the local people mingling with the farmers because we started to learn about their disease issues. And then they began to use acoustic harassment devices in 1995, which were meant to keep the seals away, but they're so loud that they're painful and they would do damage to the ears of the seals. And the whales, it was remarkable. I saw the A clans come through one family, one pot, you know, one subgroup at a time and never come back. And, you know, a year passed, 2 years passed, and I was like, okay, I'm really a whale researcher. It's time for me to go. But then I realized, oh no, that's what I did with Orky and Corky. I just walked away. And sometimes I think studying the absences is just as important as studying the presence. And so then I began to try to get the farms to turn those things off and to change their behavior so they wouldn't kill the salmon. And I'm still at that. In fact, I have another book coming out in the spring about all of that. It ended up, we occupied the farms for 280 days over the winter of 2016, 2017. And that's now the farms are getting out of that area. But this is the problem. You know, when I was reading all the books about people that went into the wilderness when I was a child and a young woman, all those books were always in three parts. And the first part of the book was always, wow. Wow, everything, the place, what you were learning about this amazing creature, the adventure, the danger, all of it. Part two was always, uh-oh, this whole thing is about to, you know, unravel because of human activity. And part three was getting the grad students in to get more data, talking to politicians, talking to industry, you know, what do you do when you see the ecosystem you're studying be destroyed? And every researcher handles it a different way. And I was absolutely determined I was going to stay in part one of my book, of my life. But that's impossible because now you're in that environment and what is happening to the whales is happening to you. It's happening to the trees. It's happening to your world. And now you are like the fingertips of society saying, hey, you better take your hand off that. You're burning. It's too hot. You're hurting yourself. And that trying to talk to the central brain is very difficult. And so I've become a huge believer in science, communication. But also activism, peaceful activism is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, you've really kind of made the transition from straightforward, unbiased science, which, you know, it can be sometimes difficult for scientists to make that shift into being more of an advocate or an activist and speaking up for the ecosystems and the species that they're studying. And so you're definitely on the conservation and advocacy side of things now. So what was it like to make that shift and that transition and kind of be more vocal on behalf of the whales and their habitat?
Well, you know, I have really transitioned. I've straddled because you can see, here's my microscope. I'm counting sea lice on juvenile salmon right now. And I'm one of the leading experts on that, of all things. I'm an advocate for a new form of science that is allowing us to actually understand the language in the cells of salmon so the salmon can speak to us. But here's the thing. So when you ask me what happened, you immediately, people distance themselves from you. You are ostracized. There's a black mark on you. Funders don't want to fund you because you might say something uncomfortable to government, to their, you know, wealthy donors. Government does not invite you to the table to talk. You get pushed out. And so you have to deal with that. And part of what I did wrong was I just let it go. It's like, okay, they don't believe me, whatever. I'm just going to keep going. But you have to go after that. When you're slandered and discredited, you have to very fairly and persistently, and in my case, I feel it's more effective as a woman, you know, to do it kindly. But don't let them do that to you, because right now, all of us out here in the field who are watching the ecosystems that make clean air and clean water and clean food get destroyed, it is our responsibility to make sure that that information is getting to wherever it needs to go to make change. And you know, I didn't think of it at first, but now I'm all about it. The only governments with the freedom to respond to this kind of information are the indigenous governments, because they're localized. They only look at one territory. They're not worrying about the price of rice and the, you know, international trade and, you know, all the rest of this that our other governments, our non-indigenous governments, are dealing with. But to take this information and empower the local indigenous governments, that is what has worked here. And it's so interesting because scientists and indigenous people initially feel very isolated and separate from each other. But as scientists watch, 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 count, 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 measure, count, watch, try to see the patterns, you can't help but end up with the same, very similar viewpoint to the indigenous people who have thousands of years of history doing that. And so I see it as riding a wave, and you're constantly having to, you know, balance that out. Don't get yourself stuck. Don't get too big. Don't get stiff. Don't get a hard opinion on anything. Just try to always be true to what you're seeing, true to your science, but adapt to the pressures that are coming at you so that you can get that message through. And, you know, take care of yourself. Make sure you get enough sleep. It's soul destroying, and I have not succeeded, but I'm watching salmon go extinct here, and I'm watching whales starve to death. I'm watching bears starve. I'm watching toxic algae blooms. And you have to really try to build the endurance and try to see this through. So you have to become outspoken as a scientist. We can't afford for scientists who really know what is going on. We can't afford to them to be afraid.
Based on, you know, all of the science that you've been doing on these net pens and their impacts to wild salmon, the occupation you mentioned a couple years ago, occupying one of the salmon farms, and working directly with First Nation governments, there has been some changes in the situation with those net pens up in your area. Can you tell us the latest news and kind of what things look like for the future?
Yes. So salmon farms have an option. They can go in a tank. It's more expensive and they don't want to do it, but they have an option. So we're not asking for the industry to be destroyed. What the First Nations did is they said, look, you guys have to get out. And so they negotiated a very long-term relationship with the federal and provincial government and the industry. And one by one, the farms are being decommissioned. They're getting taken out.
And so they took out some of the worst farms, and they're the worst because they're closest to the rivers, and the little salmon are coming up to these farms when they're just too small to take the lice. And so this spring I went out, and I have a 50-foot net that I peel out from my boat to the shore, and then I pull it in, and I scoop a bucket, and I take each fish and put it in a baggie, and I look at it under a hand lens. And these little fish without the farms were sparkling and beautiful, and their eyes were like jet black rather than all cloudy, building up cataracts from I don't know what. There were no lice hanging off of them. They were not bleeding. They were just gorgeous and perfect. And I literally, my heart started ringing like a bell, and it just kept going for days. It was just this, after, you know, 3 decades of watching things get worse, I actually was seeing them get better. Now, the companies that are doing the farming, they still don't want to go into a tank, but if I was them, I would get on that right now, because the other nations are looking at what is going on in the Broughton Archipelago and thinking, huh, how come we're stuck with this dirty thing? And so, yeah, the industry could do itself a lot of good if they would just act gracefully now and bow out and ask for support getting into a tank, because the government and the indigenous governments are willing to support them in this. But they have a model that they're operating on that doesn't allow them to adapt, so they'll break. But now we're going to see what happens. Now we're going to see, I'm hoping to see the whales come back. I'm hoping to see the algae blooms diminish. Of course, we have climate change and we have temperature changes in the ocean. So there's no normal anymore. But salmon are so remarkably adaptable. We're just remarkably adaptable. They rapid evolve to fit their rivers. So this new science, this genomic profiling, where you can read the response of their immune systems in their cells, is so powerful. You know, I came into this area to learn the language of whales, but the language that is really more accessible and perhaps more important at this moment in history is this universal language in the cells of all animals, ourselves, the fish, the whales. And if we read that as the fish are migrating, you can see where they're running into problems and whether they're dealing with low oxygen or pollution or high temperature. And then you can change our behavior. And the next year you can ask the fish, you know, did we make it better for you or not? And now we get into partnership with these animals, and we can learn how to make sure they're thriving while we thrive. And that's where we need to go. So it's an exciting time. It's a race. Now, I don't know whether I'm going to be fast enough, but it's a good chance. You know, things are going well at the moment.
Well, thank you so much for coming to chat with us today. We're really, really looking forward to this new book. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. It's going to be called Not on My Watch. And it's the 30-year battle to save this part of the coast, to save these salmon. And it's basically a guide for what not to do and what to do. Because my underlying fault was that I thought I could handle this myself, and that was wrong. But you can't build allies overnight. And so this is the difficult thing. It's all about the people. The people are the problem. The people are the solution. I've seen brilliance. I've seen nastiness. I've seen the whole gamut. And, you know, as our species is in the balance right now, is what we're going to do, I realize we are extraordinarily bad. But also, we do amazing things. So we'll see. It's about the amazing things we can do.
There's just this amazing through theme that you've mentioned in the book and now in your career of listening to whales and now listening to salmon and salmon cells and maybe even a little bit listening to people to build those connections and those allyships to take on these new problems. It's incredible, but you've definitely spent your career listening to things.
Oh, yeah.
They're my boss. They're ruthless. They don't allow downtime. But on the other hand, you know, people have to realize we've become part of the life history of all the animals on Earth right now. And if we don't pick up that role and play it responsibly, we're done. So it's a very interesting time for us to evolve.
And the book is called Listening to Whales, What the Orcas Have Taught Us. Where can people go to learn more and to pick up a copy of this book and any of your other books?
Go to your bookstore, go online, Google Alexander Morton. I have a website, alexandermorton.ca, and you can see what I'm up to. And yeah, I've written a couple of children books and books about one of the local legends in my community.
Thank you so much for coming to chat with us today. And we both wish you the best in all of your work. Again, if you would like to learn more about Orca Month, go up to orcamonth.com. This has been one of three books that we have read and interviewed the authors. We've also talked to Monica Whelan Shields and Eric Hoyt. So you can go up to whalescout.org to see more of those. And you can also go to YouTube, to our YouTube channel. Just type in Whale Scout to find video podcasts. Go up to iTunes to subscribe to our podcast as well. And to learn more about whale and dolphin conservation, please go to whales.org. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you, Whitney.